Hello, and welcome to our episode of SAS Space Power Discussions. My name is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Brown with United States Air Force, and I am a student of Class SAS 34.
My name is Major Rachel Donahoe with the Space Force, and I'm also a student of SAS Class 34.
Hello, my name is Major Ryan Lee with the Air National Guard, and I am a student of SAS Class 34 as well. To begin with, all opinions expressed here are our own and are not necessarily representative of the Department of Defense, the Air Force, or any other affiliated organizations.
Thanks, Ryan. This episode is one in a series of discussions that we and our classmates are recording about space power and space strategy as part of our Spring 2025 Space Power course at the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies, also known as SAS. With that introduction done, I'm going to hand it back over to DB.
Thanks, Rachel. Today, we are diving deep into Dr. Wendy Whitman Cobb's insightful book, Privatizing Peace and How Commerce Can Reduce Conflict in Space. I want to thank our esteemed co-hosts, Rachel and Ryan, as we unpack the nuances of this book and why it should matter to the audience. First, let's start off with the thesis. Whitman Cobb argues that there is a need for stability to promote commerce and other missions, but space powers like the U.S., China, and Russia do not find it in their interest to create more stable regime, which could potentially limit the military uses of space. Whitman Cobb maintains that economic and military aspects benefits the space and should restrain the potential conflict in space. So what does this mean? Simply put, more states are economically tied, the less they are likely to start the potential for conflict in space. Ryan, why don't you kick us off with the book summary?
Thanks, DB. So this book begins by explaining the changing nature of space and defining the space environment. Whitman Cobb introduces us to the United States space strategy and the three C's, that space is congested due to more debris being in the atmosphere than ever before, contested as that more countries compared to the Cold War involved in space exploration than ever before, and competitive as barriers to entry have been lowered. A reduction of launch cost as well as satellite production adds a commercialization to the three C's, adding the fourth C. Additionally, the global economy has become dependent on space-based assets, and all of these points essentially reinforce the notion that near-Earth space has experienced a heightened state of tension. She talks about the difference between militarization and weaponization due to the dual-use nature of space, and explains that space is already militarized from the Cold War. She introduces her arguments, two arguments in this book. The potential economic costs of conflict in space significantly reduce the chance of conflict in space, and the space races are not inherently undesirable. She talks a little bit about the space environment, where she explains that the environment itself presents unique challenges not experienced in other domains, and because of these challenges, the weaponization of space is far more dangerous than some argue. Gravity and the lack of an atmosphere present challenges of physics, costs, and debris. And then she talks about three general areas in which assets in space contribute to the global economy, namely communication satellites, remote sensing, and position, navigation, and timing, or PNT. Rachel, where does the book go from here?
Thanks, Ryan. Dr. Whitman Cobb's theory is based on her evaluation of the causal mechanisms that lead to peace between countries. These are the logics of peace in international relations theory. These theories are based on two different ideas about what makes states choose peace with each other. The first of these logics is democratic peace thesis. Democratic peace is based on the idea that no two democracies have gone to war with each other. Even though the theory seems to hold water, the actual causal factors that make it work are debated. On top of that, Whitman Cobb points out that the major space powers we tend to talk about besides us aren't reliably democratic. Russia is arguably not, and China is definitely not. An alternative to the democratic peace thesis, then, is the economic peace thesis. Economic peace is based on the idea that more economic entanglement between countries motivates them to maintain a relatively peaceful relationship. It's a question of cost versus benefit. When countries depend on each other economically, the costs of war outweigh the benefits for both of them. There's debate about the mechanisms at play in this one, too, but economic peace is the right starting point for Whitman Cobb's theory. Building off these ideas, her new concept is commercial space peace. This is based on five core premises. First, states want their economies to be successful. Second, the global economy is becoming more and more dependent on space. Because of that, states that rely on the global economy for their economic success are also becoming more and more dependent on space. Fourth, the more a state relies on space for its economy, the greater the cost of any kind of conflict in space. And finally, states have to account for space in their cost-benefit equations when considering kicking off a conflict up there. All of these premises mean that states might be more likely to negotiate with each other and take up collective action that benefits everyone. DB, do you have anything to add?
Thanks, Rachel. I really do. I really like how you brought up those logics of peace here. She has a couple other different logics as well. She has a logic of peace, a logic of cooperation, logic of conflict avoidance, and space hegemony. But the logic of the arms race is what I found where she focused and spends an entire chapter to break it down. There's two forms of arms races. Qualitative, think of the first atomic bomb. And quantitative, think about the Cold War and the Soviet and U.S. nuclear arms proliferation and the buildup of nuclear weapons. She even brings in a Greek historian, Thucydides. He predicts that the rise of emerging power necessarily leads to war. This is known as the Thucydides trap. In today's terms, we call this the security dilemma. The breakdown is this. As a powerful nation state is challenged by a rising one, the established state feels threatened and builds its military force. The emerging state seeks to further its capabilities, ultimately resulting in war, which was originally feared. In the end, states that may engage in armed races for a number of reasons, including defense, deterrence, prestige, and domestic factors. It is crucial to note that in an arms race, in fact, can be stabilizing to a degree, like Ryan pointed out. In turn, destabilized by technology and economic limits that is evidenced by the sheer cost of an arms race. The economy, think Soviet Union's eventual collapse. When it comes to certain technologies, just think about the technologies that may not even exist, no matter how stiff the competition is in the arms race. Women Cobb looked at the interdependence of the U.S. and Soviet Union's actions during the Cold War and how they impacted each other's freedom of movement in space. Each action that the opposing forces took cost money. Because of this costly interdependence, Women Cobb narrows her argument that the logic of cooperation between states is necessary to ease the tensions in the space domain, keep access to the space attainable, and also to keep space as a common good. Shifting gears, though, Whitman Cobb also charted out the different capability levels of states in the space domain called the hierarchy of space participation, where the highest prestige is to have crewed spaceflight, a.k.a. level 1A. And it went all the way down to level 4, which are passive space participants. This is the most important rise. This is also important for the rise of actors like SpaceX, ULA, Rocket Lab, and Blue Origin. They also have a hierarchy of private space actors where companies were deeply invested and want to achieve the highest prestige possible. If they achieve this highest prestige, it also can potentially turn profits. The rise of the private actors is a key that they are finding gaps in the state's capabilities and filling them with capabilities like spacelift, imagery, and resilient constellations, to name a few. Finally, to wrap up the book, Women Cobb defends her thesis by showing opportunities for space-faring states and have even more cooperation in the space domain, pushing that the competition to get more innovation, which could in turn influence states to have a new space policy changes. If cooperation continues in space, states can use the Outer Space Treaty as a baseline to build upon. There even could be a new agreed-upon code of conduct in space with additional international agreements in the future. All this is based on Whitman Cobb's thesis, which argues space economy and commercial benefits should act as a restraint on potential conflict in space. All right, I just said a lot of words. Rachel, can you tell me what you like the most about the book?
Thanks, DB. Several points really spoke to me with this book. The first is that I had struggled with the blunt force economic expansion that Dolman argued for at the beginning of our block. His recommendations felt a little careless, and he seemed unconcerned about the potential consequences of the actions he was arguing for. In that sense, I guess he was pretty unapologetically a realist. I also thought his argument relied too heavily on one single actor, presumably the U.S., having to manage and enforce the whole system. The reasoning in Astropolitik didn't resonate with me, so I just discounted the whole idea of going full speed ahead on commercializing space. But Whitman Cobb's argument brought me around. She presented more of a liberal international viewpoint, accounting for other states doing their own cost-benefit analyses and making their own choices. Commercial space peace theory isn't predicated on the U.S. being a global enforcer. It works because we know all actors will support their own best interests. By tying everyone's economies to each other, we can motivate them to actively avoid conflict. It felt more balanced and reasonable than Dolman's argument to me, and definitely more feasible. So I'm a believer in the commercialization of space now. I was also absolutely tickled by her reference to Thomas Friedman's Golden Arches theory of conflict prevention. I read his book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, in high school. It was my first foray into politics and economics, and it's stuck with me ever since. I actually decided to study that stuff in college because of that book. So Whitman Cobb's use of it here totally spoke to me. I think it was a perfect reference for showing the impact of globalization on both economics and war. Ryan, what did you like most?
Thanks, Rachel. I really had three points that resonated with me. The first, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the general structure and flow of her argument really appealed to me. In the early parts of the book, the foundational space knowledge is straightforward and easy to understand. And she logically builds an approach to her argument, particularly to her theoretical principles that serve as the foundation for her space peace theory. And I think she structures her argument in a way that's much more approachable than some of the other authors we've encountered in this course. Second, I appreciated the less idealized liberal perspective of her argument. After reading Dolman and Astropolitik, the view of space power was really, for me, viewed through a realism lens, where I weighted most of my opinion. But Whitman Cobb offers an additional perspective not rooted in the quote-unquote space is the frontier of discovery for all mankind mentality, but in a more practical view of an economically advantageous peace for all parties involved. Third, I appreciated how she addressed how rogue states are deterred from space warfare. I had continually asked myself throughout this entire course, what would prevent a rogue state or group from negatively affecting the space environment for stronger powers, as these rogue groups are less impacted by space? And Whitman Cobb explains that an attack on space assets does nothing for rogue states unless they are prepared to follow up with a more conventional attack that would capitalize on the temporary advantage. And retaliation against rogue states on the ground and in other domains presents a huge risk or very little temporary gain, which answered this question I'd been asking myself. DB, what resonated for you in this book?
Thanks, Ryan. I love Whitman Cobb's point about the Kessler syndrome, which describes a runaway debris collision where a small piece strikes a satellite that turns into another piece that strikes another satellite, and the debris field gets bigger and bigger and bigger until the orbital plane is so obstructed that you cannot use that orbit. The movie Gravity has a pretty dramatic scene in the beginning. But to put it in perspective, dramatic as space debris may seem on the surface, there is actually no incentive to clean up space, as other spacefaring states would not be able to verify that the device that the state puts in to clean the debris is not an anti-satellite device or an offensive weapon. Therefore, no party has the incentive to practice responsible stewardship, thus resulting into the tragedy of the commons, where no one is responsible for the cleanup of near-Earth space. Since no one is responsible for it, no one will do it. It's a really sad conclusion here that Whitman Cobb brings up, and I thought it was a salient point about her book. All right, Ryan, let's go right back to you and move on to the most critical takeaway that the audience should have from her book.
So for me, the most critical takeaway is the one that is foundational to her theory, in that this collective economic commercial benefit of space should act as a restraint on potential conflict in space. Space has direct global economic consequences as states globally have grown dependent on these space capabilities. Conflict is discouraged because of the potential for damage to each country's economic health. Add to this that commercialization has allowed less powerful states to have skin in the game, essentially, which gives them an advantage. However, it also gives them something to potentially lose. One point that she made that was particularly resonating with me is when she talks about the incident in January of 2016, in which the U.S. Air Force took one of its 31 GPS satellites offline. This resulted in just a 13 millionths of a second error in the timing system. As a result, in parts of the U.S. and Canada, police, fire, and EMS radio systems stopped functioning. The BBC radio is out for almost 2 days in many areas, and there were even anomalies detected in the power grid. So something as simple as a 13 millionths of a second error resulted in global impact, which I think reinforces her main takeaway point very well. Rachel, what did you want the audience to take away from this book?
Thanks, Ryan. A major takeaway I had about this book that surprised me was the idea that a space race is not inherently bad. Competition reduces costs and improves products and technologies for everyone. It also reduces barriers to access for consumers and smaller states. Not only does that make space cheaper and more accessible for everyone, but as a knock-on effect, it encourages everyone to adopt more space technology. This, in turn, makes more states more reliant on space. And by increasing reliance, we get more parties committed to maintaining stability in the domain. When actors share common interests, they're more likely to cooperate, too. They may also build some trust with each other when they understand that we all want the same things to stay peaceful. Basically, the competition of a space race lowers costs and improves technology while also potentially fostering more international cooperation, or at least collective action. DB, what did you think was most important?
Thanks, Rachel. I find it very interesting how domestic politics played a role in the U.S. space race. Nixon knew that there was not a missile gap between the Soviets and the U.S. at the time of the election. And in fact, the missile gap was in the U.S.'s favor. But he remained quiet during the elections to continue to allow the space race to have two tracks. One was for the country's prestige, with a civilian focus to put a man on the moon. The second track was in the terms of developing military capabilities. So let's switch gears. And as we talked about a lot of good things about this book, because there's a lot of them, how about some critiques? Rachel, what do you have?
As the token cyber person in our group, I always fight any premise that assumes cyber can't be used maliciously in all domains. I'm going to be extremely hypothetical here and just talk about what's in the realm of the possible and not any specific capabilities. But Whitman Cobb says that cyber and electronic warfare don't constitute space warfare because they're really just attacking the data that transits space and not space assets themselves. This is based on the idea that they aren't physical attacks in space. I disagree because it's totally feasible to generate physical effects through cyber and EW actions. And these effects can totally be within the space domain or on a space asset. Satellites are delicately balanced pieces of equipment exposed to incredible physical forces all the time. It doesn't take a lot to mess that up. A small instrumentation tweak here, a missed command window there, even the tiniest oscillation in a launched rocket can cause it to tear itself apart because of the incredible speeds it's moving at. Space is so hostile that we have to constantly, proactively keep equipment alive up there. All that has to happen to break a space asset is to prevent it from actively keeping itself alive or use it against its design specifications. Misuse can be catastrophic, and cyber is all about intentional misuse. There's also no technical limitation out there that says a cyber attack will always have to originate from the ground. Again, I'm speaking totally hypothetically here, but in theory, any computer can be turned into patient zero for a cyber attack. And all of these space systems rely on data. That data isn't just getting relayed from the ground. There's also data being generated on the satellite itself that's responsible for all of its normal operations, like controlling a camera or charging a battery. Course adjustment also requires data. In other words, computers. Every machine can be made to act against its purpose. A satellite is a machine, and we can't rule out that it could also be made to act against its purpose. I had the same critique with all of our blocks that relegated cyber to something outside the physical domains. It may be invisible, but it can definitely have real physical impacts on each domain. Ryan, how about you?
Thanks, Rachel. So like DB, I was very pleased with this book. The only critique I have, if it can even be called a critique, is that early in the book when Whitman Cobb outlines her arguments against the weaponization of space, I feel that these same arguments can also be made to advocate for the weaponization of space. So the first argument is that the physics of space are different as debris remains in the environment after conflict. I would offer that if a less powerful adversary can increase debris from one piece to many through a kinetic attack or simply by creating one dead satellite through a non-kinetic attack such as lasers or cyber, an argument can be made that all methods to defend against such an attack or end the conflict as quickly as possible through the weaponization of space should be carried out. Second argument is that international laws, treaties, and protocols are far more extensive in other domains than what exists for space. Again, I would offer that an argument can be made that the lack of international consensus regarding space is all the more reason to ensure the U.S. retains the ability to enforce its will and project power in a manner that provides a strategic advantage to U.S. interests. The final argument is that on Earth, borders are recognized internationally, but this is not the case in space, where no territorial boundaries exist. Like the previous point, the anarchic nature of states operating in a domain that is marginally regulated at best suggests that these rising powers will attempt to occupy areas of space that improve their strategic advantage. While this is a realist approach to space power, an argument can be made from the U.S. perspective anyway, that it is better to have a state with a flawed but reasonable oversight to weaponize space rather than a more unpredictable adversary of the U.S. While I agree with the overarching argument that space is a different domain that requires unique consideration regarding weaponization, these points can also be utilized to advocate for weaponization. DB, what critiques do you have with this book?
Thanks, Ryan. So my only critique is that if all these disruptive companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, and other ones that are going to reduce the cost of the space launches, those would make the entire space domain more unstable. I feel this way because as you can add more and more actors in space without any rules or norms to how to operate in space, this will further exacerbate the tragedy of the commons issue, making space less stable in the long run. And so even though she brings up the goodness of these companies, I also can see a negative consequence that all these countries now, or all these actors that are operating in space, can make the finite area more unstable. Ryan, back to you. What does this book tell us about space strategy compared to the other readings we've had in the course?
So throughout this book, I kept going back to Ashley Vance's When the Heavens Went on Sale. So as commercial space companies grow, they inherently have to become more bureaucratic. There's this parallel with Silicon Valley tech industry and idealism of creating a quote-unquote better world. But eventually, I feel like all of these companies have to come to term with cash flow, i.e. fighting for venture capital, government contracts, et cetera. So two assumptions in Whitman Cobb's theory in her book. One is that states are the central actors, and two, that states are rational actors. Now, while states are still the main actors in space, will they be overtaken by new space companies, and will those companies act in the best interests of the state or in the best interests of profit? I agree with her commercial space theory, but I wonder if eventually these new space companies will grow in a manner that turns them into these monsters of commerce that they initially claimed to fight so hard against. We have to remember that companies like Lockheed and Boeing had to start somewhere. And as we shift to looking at companies such as SpaceX and Elon Musk and how power and political influence is at the highest level of government is currently playing a role, I wonder if the long-term benefits of space conflict being bad for business might be eventually overcome with a short-term gain of profit for the purposes of destabilization, such as space weaponization. Notably different in Vance's text, I thought, was the company's Rocket Lab and Astra, how they approached space commercialization and gaining credibility were different. In the end, does power and prestige always take over? I think so, but I really hope I'm wrong, and Whitman Cobb's argument has significantly swayed my opinion away from the cold realism I began the course with. Rachel, what links did you make with other texts we encountered in the course?
I liked how Whitman Cobb advocated for laws, treaties, and norms, and I connected that with Anya Pachulich in her book, The Space Law Stalemate. This was in pretty big contrast to Dolman, on the other hand, who advocates for pulling out of or renegotiating agreements like the Outer Space Treaty. His position is that these constrain U.S. actions and prohibit us from claiming sovereignty in space. Dolman also thinks that law hinders the development of space. In contrast, Whitman Cobb and Pachulich are for having laws, treaties, and norms because they support the commercialization of the space domain by adding stability and predictability. Whitman Cobb points out that the Outer Space Treaty doesn't actually constrain our actions in any meaningful way. It hasn't curbed the development of space so far. Mining and other claims to resources aren't explicitly forbidden by the OST either. Its peaceful purposes clause has been interpreted in a way that's pretty convenient for us, and that peaceful just means non-aggressive. And any global economic improvement can be justified as for the benefit of all mankind. it's better to have some rules in place than no rules at all. And there are precious few rules in space right now anyway. While we might have to revise these treaties or norms in the future, right now they're not preventing us from doing what we want for economic gain. So we might as well keep them. DB, what do you think?
Thanks, Rachel. I can't help but to think about the book, Bowen's book, Original Sin, and how rocket technology came from the labor of concentration camps, and it was created by Nazi scientists. This technology continued to progress in order for missile defense, nuclear arms, and it kept having this technology connected to massive loss of life. This same technology also connects people around the world with communications, imagery, satellite, SATCOM, and other areas. I think this is important for many reasons. One, technology is not inherently evil. Even though the space race came to proliferate nuclear weapons, it has also allowed the U.S. to put the first man on the moon. This is important for many reasons. One, technology is not inherently evil. Even though the space race came about from the proliferation of nuclear weapons, but it also allowed the U.S. to put a man on the moon. This dual-use concept is important to Whitman Cobb's cooperation idea and Bowen's original sin of the space have always been militarized. So it leaves me to ponder whether we can decouple the technology of the past and make uses for it. I personally think you can, and Whitman Cobb's books showcases this with her commercial space peace theory. All right, so now that we've talked about this book, what do you think? Do you think we should put it in a SAS curriculum or not? Ryan, how about you lead us off?
So I really enjoyed this book, honestly. Going back to kind of my structure argument, what I really like about Whitman Cobb's book is she doesn't turn a 130-page book into a 500-page book that doesn't need to be there. The arguments are short, they're concise, they're easy to understand, and they're very approachable for different audiences. I think this book should absolutely remain in SAS and arguably even earlier in the space course because it's so approachable to not just SAS students and academics, but actual practitioners in the Air Force, in the Space Force, and really in any capacity within space where there is an interest to learn more about what privatization of peace means and her space theory argument. I think it's a great read. Rachel, what do you think?
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. I would also put this book in the SAS curriculum. I think it's a great counterpoint to Dolman at the beginning of the block. It's one of the few books that I've read in SAS that really gets into the economic aspects of national power. We talk a lot about the military instrument, obviously, but we also talk a lot about the diplomatic and informational sides in SAS. We've spent very little time, in contrast, talking about the economic aspect of power. It's also a breath of fresh liberal air in a course that leans super realist. SAS has a tendency to harp on the realist aspects of a lot of these ideas. So I think it offers an important perspective we haven't seen much of. And to me, it's a more convincing argument for commercializing space than Dolman presents. DB, what are your thoughts?
Rachel, I couldn't agree more. I really think that this book should be added to the SAS curriculum, mainly because it provides that different perspective that you talked about. Most of our books for the space course have been realist-lensed, and so because it has that realist lens, there is not a lot of room for cooperation. Specifically, let's just go to the realist lens, and we shoot a satellite, and it blows up, and it continues to stay in orbit for years and years and years and years and years. There's no answer to that from the realist lens. Dr. Whitman Cobb shows that if we were to do that, it would stay up there. And that is, I think, a very good point that anyone could learn from. So this has been a truly insightful discussion. I want to thank our two co-hosts and panelists, Rachel and Ryan, for sharing their experience. And thank you to our listeners for joining us as we explore the intricate arguments of privatizing peace. Keep looking up and continue to wonder what's out there.